Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by endocrinologynetwork.com, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on endocrinologynetwork.com.
So, Natalie, there have been so many amazing sessions. It has been so hard to attend everything. I am really glad that they're being recorded so I can go back and see things. But I wanted to talk about some of the things that we have seen so far. And one of the ones I've been really excited about was actually the Beta Bionics readout, which was occurred on Friday, the first day, formal day of the conference. And we were actually at Cleveland Clinic, we were one of the sites. So that was especially exciting to kind of see the report out on the data. For our viewers who might not be as familiar, the Beta Bionics is a very unique pump. It's called the iLet. And what's unique about it is it's an automated insulin delivery system, but it works with the CGM, but there's no settings that you program. So normally with pumps, you have to put in the basal rates, your insulin to carbohydrate ratio, your correction factor, your active insulin time. There's all these settings, right? With the iLet, there is none of that. You actually only put in the patient's weight, and then you connect them to the CGM and the study that Dexcom G6 is used, and then boom, you go bionic. You start the iLet. So this was a randomized controlled trial done over 13 weeks, and in this session, they actually reported out in different components of it. So for example, the pediatric arm, the adult arm, they had an arm that was using the rapid acting insulin or the ultra rapid acting insulin, the FIAS, the faster aspart. And so they reported out all of that, and across the board, the A1C reductions were great. I mean, significant reductions. That time spent in target range increased significantly, all with this very simple design. The other really fascinating thing is they reported on the patient-reported outcomes. So, like, how did they feel using the system? What did they like about it? And across the board, I would say the feedback was just so positive in terms of the ease of use, the convenience. And part of that is the fact that when you eat for meals, for example, I mean, you know this, like normally we train patients, they have to enter in their carbs, they have to be really exact. And with this pump, you actually put basically small, usual, or large. So there's none of that exact carb counting. Now, I was a pump trainer at our site, so we definitely educated patients on what is small, medium, large, right? Like it could be you having a small piece of cake, but for you that's large because that's more carbohydrates than you might normally have with your meal. But I was just really kind of blown away with these outcomes, and I don't know, I'm excited. What do you think?
I think it's a great solution for a lot of patients. One of the things that we have to understand is 50% of the patients with type 1 don't see an endocrinologist. We need to have a product that can be used in primary care, and this really does feel like that. We could use it in endocrinology, of course, but this makes a big difference. The other thing I'm really excited about is the diversity of the patients that they recruited.
Yes.
Their recruitment was patients with very high A1Cs, and other diverse economic diverse backgrounds that other studies didn't look at. So they had patients with A1Cs greater than 13%, and their outcomes were phenomenal. And I think that's a big part of it too. I think when a patient doesn't have to put in a carbohydrate amount, 38, 42, what's the right number? Should I correct this? How do I do it? If we can take some of that away, I think we are opening up an ability to treat diabetes for a vast number of patients that didn't have access to a pump before.
That's a really great point. They did enroll a significant number of patients from underserved populations, which we know historically have just been underrepresented in so many trials. So the full publication is not published yet, so I am looking forward to kind of seeing a little bit more of the safety data. In the top line results, it looked comparable, but definitely assessing more just the level of hypoglycemia, because there's a little bit less customization with this pump in terms of if someone's going to exercise, there's not a specific exercise mode. You can suspend it, but there's not like an exercise mode like we see with other pumps. So it'll be interesting. And I know now they're enrolling for the dual hormone, which will be glucagon and insulin. So that would really add kind of another safety level, because if someone was going low, then you've got that glucagon in the pump. Of course, there's a lot of questions with that. You know, how feasible is it? Is someone going to want to wear a site that has glucagon and insulin and their CGM, right? So now they're wearing three different sites. And then cost, we don't really know long term, like, is the benefit worth the cost? But that's why we do these studies. So I'm really excited about kind of the future with that. Stay tuned, everyone.
I think that is one of the questions that we have is, how do you cover glucagon? And they'll use stable glucagon. They will not use our old-fashioned mix and you know, deliver emergency. There is now stable glucagon available on the market, but what kind of cost will it be to keep enough of it in a pump for all the time? But I am very excited about their initial data, and I look forward to hopefully soon hearing more about their next phase.
Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, we've seen a lot of data reported out here. And I know there's recently been some new Control IQ data. So curious your thoughts on what you've heard about that.
So I think that real world data helps us as clinicians to decide, is this product really what it is? When you do a study, they're very controlled. So the patient comes in and they get this much education and it's very formalized. When you look at real-world data, which the Control IQ is able to do because the pumps are uploaded into their software. So one of the things with this group of very large group of patients is patients with GMI, glucose management indicator, which is estimated A1C, greater than 8, their time in range increased by 2.2 hours per day. And the biggest impression of that is that this is 19,000 patients. This isn't that controlled study patient that is being seen on a regular basis. So I'm very excited about that data.
And I see that real world with my patients. I mean, it's really incredible. Even the ones who are not really as engaged in their care and are not like regularly bolusing on time, we still see unbelievable improvements. Like often they're able to maintain 50 to 60% time in range, which I've got people working so hard on non-automated systems, not able to achieve that. And then when people are engaged and they are bolusing, I mean, it is very typical that people are over 80% in range that I see in my patients. And the funny thing is they want more. They're like, let's work together and see what we can tweak. And often we can tweak it to get even higher. But it's just, it really has been incredible how these systems have helped people.
Absolutely. And the Omnipod 5 has been FDA approved and released, and there's some new data on the Omnipod 5 at this conference. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know the exact data, but I can speak anecdotally that it's been impressive in terms of the patients I've seen so far that have started the system. Just the kind of simplicity and the fact that it is tubeless, that offers kind of a novel option that we haven't seen with other automated insulin delivery systems. So, so far it's been really, I think, just really convenient and taken off a lot of the burden from patients of like, just having to think all the time, having to micromanage their condition all the time.
I have seen some phenomenal results with the Omnipod 5, and it is a limited launch. Not all insurance companies are covering it at this point, but the data has been in my patient population. And at our office, we see Medicare, Medicaid, private pay, cash pay. We have seen really phenomenal results across the board.
Yeah, and it's actually expanded quite a bit in our area. So now more, like even my own employee health plan is covering it. So it's really, I've got a lot of people lined up that are going to be starting it in the next like week or so. So I want to switch gears a little bit because Natalie, you were a speaker here and you did so, so well on this amazing session about time and range. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your session.
So my specific session was about looking at how do we implement CGM into everyday. How do we make it easy to look at? And one of the models I discussed was the data model. And the data model talks about, it can be used, you download the data, you assess for hypoglycemia, you work with the patient and come up with some actionable insights and look at their time and range and have a conversation with them about days that are working very well and time and range is high, and then approach the patient asking them with their permission to talk about the days where their time and range wasn't as high, and really engage in the patient to try to peel back that what is happening on a day-to-day basis to improve their time and range. And then the second model we looked at comes out of Dr. Bergenstahl's and Martin's out of Park Nicolet at the Diabetes Center there. And it is a model that for primary care providers that says, look at a couple of different measurements and you can make some decisions. So the first one is, are they greater than 70% time in range or less than 70% time in range? Are they greater than 2% time below range or less than 2% time below range? And they actually looked at the mobile study data, the AGPs in the mobile study, to come up with that 2% versus 4%. And I think when we are looking at data, we really want much less than 4% below, even though that's where the ADA, the consensus recommendations are at this point. And then they've created a decision tree as to what to do, whether you increase insulin, decrease insulin, add GLP-1, stop sulfonylurea, based on those four data points. So they haven't published yet, but there are, our recording is available. But also, they did speak at ATTD. Dr. Martin spoke and Dr. Bergenstahl spoke there. And they actually did speak a little bit about it at ADA on Friday at this conference.
Yeah, one of the key takeaways that I took was that, so we've got these different models out there, which help, but they're not validated. So definitely an area of research and opportunity is how can we validate these models and also just really spread the knowledge about it, because that's one of the common questions I get from people is, okay, I'm an advocate of CGM, of technology, but like, how do we really, like, what do we do with the data? How do we efficiently look at it? I also attended a session this morning that really got me thinking. So one of the things with the data model is that we focus that T is time in range. So we really focus on how can we replicate times of the day or days where time in range is the highest. And the idea being we focus on the positive instead of trying to nitpick the things that aren't going well, right? But one of the interesting things that came up today was you could find someone's on their CGM report, like their quote unquote best day, right, where time and range is the highest, but you've got to ask them about it, because what if you have a situation where someone's facing food insecurity and the reason they have the highest time and range is because they didn't eat all day because they didn't have access to food, right? So that really, like, we might call that the best day, but that's not like the best for the person with diabetes. So I think that's where part of what I love about the data model is it involves that discussion with the person. It's not just you look at it and you're like, okay, we'll do this.
Right.
It's that it comes up with the questions we're going to ask. It engages that discussion. And then what you do may be very different. And I know you showed a bunch of examples where it might, you know, someone's GMI, average glucose, A1C might be elevated, and it might be intuitive, oh, we want to go up on, like, the long-acting insulin, right? But really, we end up de-prescribing. We end up de-escalating, because what's really happening is the person's eating all the time because they're worried about hypoglycemia. And so what we do is actually completely different than just if we're just looking at the data, right?
I think that is one of the biggest things that we see when we look at data from across the board, is that we have to ask, we have to talk to people. Our patients are people and they have lives and they do things every day. And sometimes it's not exactly what we would like it if we could keep them in a bed all day. I can keep their blood sugars perfect, but that's not living. And what we're trying to do with our patients is have a conversation. So one of the biggest questions I ask every single patient, do you have to have a snack to avoid low blood sugars? Do you have a snack before bed because you like it or because you need it? Do you have a snack at 3 o'clock because you like it or because you need it? Because that helps us drive our prescribing and changing insulin dosing, but it also helps the patient. If we just keep giving more and more insulin or medication and they keep gaining a little bit of weight. If you gain 3 pounds a year for 10 years, I've created a patient who's not only obese, but now has a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. That's what we're trying to avoid. And what the data model helps us do is have a conversation so that we learn that earlier on in the process of using a CGM as opposed to waiting.
Right. There was also a couple other really good talks. I mean, the whole amazing, but Roy Back really laid out the landscape of the metrics in terms of like cardiovascular outcomes, microvascular outcomes with time and range. And I was excited to see that there's actually quite a number of papers that even linked time and range from the DCCT trial and show what we would expect, that increased time and range shows less microvascular and even less cardiovascular complications. So that was amazing to see. Grazia Aleppo, oh my gosh, she's incredible. She's a firecracker. And Earl Hirsch, so he did a great job of closing it out. And I liked what he said about the GRI, that new metric, the glycemic risk index, from David Klonoff and colleagues. And it basically, for those that don't know, it's a new metric to really assess the quality of glycemia. But he showed a few examples of how if someone has more complications, they may end up having the same risk score as someone else with less, but really their situation would be a lot different and you may not want to adjust therapy or intensify therapy. And so that metric, it's very interesting, but he said he wants to basically dive a little bit more into it, calculate it more for his patients and kind of see where it takes us. So that was really interesting.
I think he did a really good job. He had three case studies, one of which the glycemic risk index played exactly where we would expect it to, right? This patient's at a pretty high risk because they're having, and what the glycemic risk index does is it gives us a measurement of, it creates a number basically from 0 to 100 about the risk of, and what, and of glycemia excursions. So it gives a higher priority to lows than highs. And so what he did was his first patient fit that perfectly. And their glycemic risk index was at a perfect place. And then he did two patients that their glycemic risk index was wrong. And we would have said, no, absolutely, we need to change something. So his basic conclusion was, I need to play with this a little bit more. It's not ready for prime time because the elderly or patients with multiple comorbidities, it doesn't work as well. So maybe this is a number for some patients and not all patients. And I think we all need to go back to clinic and see what we do with the numbers.
Yeah. So to kind of close this off here, Natalie, I want to ask you what you are most excited about at ADA, or what you've seen so far, or what you're looking forward to before the end of the conference.
So I'm very excited about the tirzepatide SURMOUNT readouts, right? That to me is a game changer, mm-hmm. right? It will change our clinical practice.
Sure, yeah.
I'm excited that the Libre 3 has been FDA approved last week and is going to launch soon. They're expecting it in our practices shortly. I'm also really excited. I think ADA does a really good job of behavioral health and discussing behavioral health and how much diabetes becomes a psychological, there's a big psychological component to managing diabetes. And I think that it gets lost in the shuffle too often and in our day-to-day management. And we only send the most severe people, the people that have severe depression. And we really need to think about the behavioral health aspect of diabetes more on the forefront. And the ADA offers an amazing track for behavioral health, and that is one of my favorite things to attend to help me become a better clinician in dealing with my patients every day.
That's awesome. I totally agree. And I'm also just really excited about the choice of technology that we're seeing. So for me, I love going through the expo and visiting the different booths. And for example, I'll tell you, I like the POGO meter, right? I know we love CGM, right? But not everyone's using CGM. And the idea that there's a meter where you just put your finger on it, you don't have to have these separate lancets, which we know people like never change, but it automatically does it. So it's so much more convenient. I thought that was cool. And hopefully I'll get a demo sent to me about that. But also just the other options. I mean, we have patch pumps, right? We have the Simplicity, the Vigo. Now we have Libre 3 that was FDA approved, and Omnipod 5. But I would say it's not enough. And I would say that the FDA is still, I want them to see faster, because I've heard rumblings that, oh, like, we have AID system. What do we need another one for? What do we need another CGM device for? We have one approved. And I would say that there are differences between these devices. Like, we know Omnipod 5 is different from Control-IQ, which will be different from Medtronic 780G. And I want my patients to have these choices. And so my hope for the future is that devices like 780G, Dexcom's G7, do get that approval, even the iLet, right? That the get these approvals so we can really offer our patients choices. And I'm glad to see all the program and hear about the importance of choice and really breaking down those disparities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree.
So with that, I want to thank everyone for attending today and wishing you all the best.